You've lost 11 governor's mansions and 12 Senate seats reflecting the post-Trump wins of Ralph Northam in Virginia and Doug Jones in Alabama. You lost 69 seats in the House of Representatives. Most important, you've lost almost 1,100 seats in state legislatures, which largely control the redistricting process and which produce the farm team candidates who will run in the future. They help build the local and state party cadres of activists and volunteers who knock on doors, make calls, and do the grunt work of campaigns. Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, memes, and the other modern appurtenances of campaigning are necessary, but not necessarily sufficient. Trump hatred is good fuel for your voters, but it's not quite enough to get you over the hump and into the majority again. You need to buckle down, get the data, targeting, and operational things right again before you win back even part of what we took from you. You'll have to run candidates who don't fit the top-down standards of Upper West Side Democrats. Let's have some real talk about Hillary Clinton. She was a catastrophically terrible, horrible, crap-tier candidate, and she always has been. Democrats will sputter about her accomplishments, her stature, her work as a senator and secretary of state, and still look away from the hard truth of politics. Sometimes politicians have the gift. Sometimes they don't. Hillary never did. Not once. Not for a moment. Her campaign team mastered one trick, the elite media psychological warfare game that blinded the press to just how god-awful she was as a candidate. I watched the birth of Hillary Clinton's elected political career. It wasn't pretty. As the communications strategist in Rudy Giuliani's doomed U.S. Senate race against Hillary in 1999 and into the spring of 2000 when Giuliani left the race, I had a ringside seat. It was the terrible aftermath of the Monica Lewinsky scandal that put Hillary in contention for the seat. Her position as the wronged woman came screaming out of every focus group we conducted. New Yorkers, seeing her as a feminist champion, an arguable point, but we'll fight that out another time, were ready to give her a chance because Bill had treated her so execrably. We also knew the voters of New York thought she wasn't particularly relatable, credible, or engaging. She had one stroke of political luck in her entire life. Rudy's, ahem, troubled marriage to Donna Hanover had been page six and gossip fodder for years. In early 2000, it collapsed in a public, messy wreck that kept the campaign team in a state of spin frenzy in an attempt to shut down a story that had been a long time in coming. Rudy's bad news got much, much worse. After being diagnosed with prostate cancer, he withdrew from the race. Rudy's replacement was the affable but doomed Rick Lazio, who ran an affable but doomed campaign. It was never even close to being a serious competition. You can't beat a celebrity without a celebrity, and Rudy was the only person who could have defeated her. Hillary could have run the remainder of the race from a hot tub and won. She phoned in her 2006 re-election and got her head handed to her by Barack Obama in 2008. We know how 2016 ended. Hillary's unnatural affect and clunky style never worked. She operated from behind a brittle shell of caution, overthinking, scar tissue, and the gnawing fear that a dead hooker would turn up in Bill's bedroom. I know this will anger Hillary fans, but inertia alone is not enough to win the White House, and that was what drove more than a few voters to back her. Never a gifted, graceful, or natural speaker, Hillary's constant mental self-auditing was always visible. I will now run human interaction subroutine 54.1. Warm smile followed by sincere chuckle. Without using the phrase, first woman president, try to name the actual predicates of Hillary's campaign. Unless you're an HRC campaign insider, you can't. There was never a there for most voters outside of the usual partisan autopilot. She was a Democrat, and tribal gravity being what it is, she ran up the numbers any generic Democratic candidate would. Some of you will object, saying, but she won the popular vote. Yes, she did. But those aren't the rules of the game, whether you like it or not. Democrats have long enjoyed the blue wall in the Electoral College, in which California, New York, Massachusetts, and a handful of other large liberal states give them a handy edge. But just as Bill Clinton famously picked the lock on the GOP's Reagan and Bush-era Electoral College map, Hillary took that advantage for granted in Wisconsin and elsewhere. While we're on the subject of the GOP's secret weapons, I'll name another. Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi may raise a metric crap ton of money for the Democrats, but she sets the rest of America's teeth on edge. Ever wonder why we stuck her in candidate and super PAC ads against you until Trump came along? Because it worked for a long, long time. Only Trump has made her more palatable. Nancy Pelosi doesn't test well with focus groups, to put it mildly. Before my liberal friends howl, this isn't sexism. It's long-term observed data from dozens of focus groups and surveys over the years. She scans as harsh, shrill, partisan, and out of touch to Republicans, and importantly, an enormous swath of independents. We used her against you because she's a convenient shorthand for the things many Americans see as culturally and socially disconnected from their lives. It's not nice, but it is politics. She has also, to put it bluntly, lost a step in the past few years. The rest of the House and Senate Democratic leadership isn't much better. I know you all love Aunt Nancy, but it's time for her to retire to a farm upstate after you win the majority in the fall of 2018. The Democrats desperately need a younger, smoother, smarter set of public faces for their party if they're going to compete. In a perfect world, we'd be fighting over policy and not worrying about appearances. This is, quite clearly, not a perfect world. Middle America scans the cliché New York, Boston, San Francisco liberal sneer as a judgment on their lives, their values, their faith, and their culture. Do the great unwashed sometimes deserve it? Sure. Would it help expand the brand if you didn't rub things in their face that may be normal in Berkeley but repulsive in Middle America? More than you think. The siren song of the first is the Democratic Party's greatest temptation. The first woman, the first African American, the first one-legged furry aficionado. You love the branding of shattering the blah, blah, blah. Sorry, my eyes glazed over. Stop it. When it's a genuine first, someone who has put in the work, done their time in the vineyard, made the long crawl up the political mountain, their accomplishments should speak for themselves. Recruit candidates who have done things in the world, built businesses, fought in our wars, accomplished something more than doofy do-gooderism at nonprofits. Think best, not first. Too often, the first comes across as a novelty more than substance. Just as I've called down the fire on my party for adopting an ideological monoculture after 2010 and their current cult-like devotion to Trump Juche, you need some tough love. Another reason we took over 1,100 legislative seats from you over the past 15 years is your top-down ideology. Florida is not Vermont. Michigan is not Wyoming. New York is not North Carolina. As long as you insist on a single set of national standards for your party candidates, you limit the regions, states, and districts in which you can effectively compete. If every Democrat has to be adamantly pro-abortion and can never, ever even begin to express a moral qualm about the subject, you're going to have trouble reaching meaningful chunks of the Catholic electorate and Protestant evangelicals. Even in cases where Democrats could pick up seats with a pro-life candidate, the party, its allies, and its leadership will almost always pick a losing pro-abortion candidate instead. Government-funded drive-through abortion on demand at the end of the third trimester is a great message in Manhattan and Seattle. For the Pittsburgh suburbs and among Catholic Democrats in Wisconsin, not so much. Abortion has also become one of the definitional characteristics of what it means to be a Democrat. For your base, that works, but you keep missing the nuance. Americans are divided on the issue, but have reached a broad, if tacit, social compromise. Tolerance for the practice, but with a sea of moral qualms and conditions. And yes, I've done work for pro-abortion Republicans in places where a pro-life GOPer would never survive. We had to fight inside our party primaries to win, so you're not alone in facing this kind of compromise. If you're mad at me for touching on one of your most sacred cows, you might want to get a glass of Chardonnay before reading the next section. Yes, ideological rigidity on abortion costs you votes in the aggregate outside of coastal enclaves, but it's nothing at all compared to guns. Do you want to know how we beat you over and over and over? This is going to sting for my Democratic friends, but one of the easiest ways for people on my side to disqualify you with large chunks of American voters is the subject of guns. I know, for you, gun control is a central article of the liberal faith. I know that Parkland convinced you that everything changed. As telegenic as the Parkland kids are, guns are wired into America's DNA in a way that they and you don't grasp. I'm not saying you don't come at it from a well-meaning perspective or reasons that seem perfectly cogent in your head. You see violence caused by people and ascribe it to the tool they used. You genuinely believe you can regulate it away. Bless your hearts. You genuinely think gun control is a winner at the polls and a decisive voting issue. It's not. Gun control and gun violence make it into the top 10 of any most important problem polling question panel for about a minute after a tragedy like Parkland, then fall back to where they usually live, in the 1 to 5% range. Jobs, the economy, the direction of the nation, and national security still drive voter decisions. Gun control hasn't and doesn't. Most of you don't understand guns and the role they play in America's culture away from the coasts. You can't grasp the millions and millions of Americans who own guns, hunt, shoot for sport or pleasure, or carry for self-defense, hear your attacks on guns as attacks on them. Most of you Democrats still don't realize the way you speak about guns is a signifier of political hostility to Americans who long ago made up their minds on the matter. You conflate them with the people who commit these crimes, and you do it constantly, tendentiously, and with the worst goddamn nanny state condescension. In an ironic twist, about 35% of the 1.4 million people in Florida who have a concealed carry permit are Democrats. You guys don't even understand your own base. I can hear your objections already. What about Parkland, Las Vegas, Sandy Hook? What about? I get it. No one thinks crazy people should own guns, including the staunchest NRA member. I'm not arguing policy with you here. I'm telling you what the real politics are, and they're not what you think. First, you're fooling absolutely no one with the phrase sensible gun safety. We all know perfectly well that phrase came out of a focus group. You say that, and red state voters hear gun confiscation. You conflate criminals and the insane with lawful gun owners and users, and you can't imagine why my side doesn't think you're reasonable. Let me use an esoteric technical polling phrase for you. Americans fucking love guns. Your position on guns is poison to one group you might consider winning once in a while. Almost every white male in the country over the age of 35. Democrats also miss a key element of the NRA debate. You can hate the NRA and call it a domestic terrorist organization all you want, but unlike Moms Demand Action, they deliver something for candidates beyond campaign cash. They deliver committed, passionate, single-issue, do-or-die voters. They organize. They do the hard work of campaigning. They mobilize. It's not about their money. It's about their effort and turnout. Democrats are missing a massive market opportunity in the era of Trump, one that could move votes and donations that could rebuild their party. It'll take some work, but there's a clear pathway for the Democrats to become the party of fiscal sanity, probity, and responsibility. I find it hard to write those words, but it's true. Under Trump, the GOP wholly abandoned any pretense that we cared about the debt, the deficits, or borrowing trillions of dollars to fund our political wish list. Fiscal conservatism is a dead letter in my party, and there's very little stopping the Democrats from picking up the mantle. We once roundly mocked the Democrats as the liberal free shit party, but with Trump writing checks like a drunken sailor blowing his entire paycheck on hookers at Olongapo after 3 months at sea, we've lost that privilege. All you have to do is face down your own free shit caucus. Looking at you, Bernie Sanders. Democrats ended their years in the wilderness with Bill Clinton, who ran as an economic and political centrist. He pushed the party to the right, and in the famous formulation of James Carville, picked the electoral lock. The economic future of the country is going to be radically different than the recent past. There's an opportunity for Democrats bold enough to move back in the center of the economic spectrum. The Republicans have certainly abandoned it. What to expect when you're working for Trump? Act 5. You're not naive. You've been to the rodeo a time or two, and you know D.C. is filled with crafty, shitty people who hate your success. What you didn't expect was that the friendly fire now raining down on you was going to come from inside the White House. What you didn't count on was that every faction inside the White House would be leaking about you, shitting you out to every reporter with Signal or Confide. Jared hates you, though he keeps giving you these weird come-hither looks in cabinet meetings. Ivanka hates you because Jared keeps giving you the aforementioned looks. Kelly hates you because he's mad at the world. Miller hates you because you look like a meal he could digest for a week after he unhinges his snake jaw. What you really didn't expect was that the president himself would get on the phone at night with Maggie or Jonathan or Michael and crap all over you. You can imagine him stalking around the residence, his sweaty, doll-sized hand gripping his phone while sniffing out, "Say, the president has lost confidence in him. Yeah, do that." Now comes the moment you've been dreading. You know the hammer is coming, but you hope against hope that Trump won't humiliate you. Then, there it is. The tweet. You read it through a narrow gray tunnel as your vision constricts. You're out. You know what happens next. The people who loved you yesterday will now rip you to shreds. Reading Breitbart's headlines about you, to say nothing of the comments section, is like watching a pack of wild dogs tear apart the corpse of your reputation. You know Tucker and Laura and Sean and Rush, once such good friends, will blame you, not Trump. It can't get worse. Then it does. A story breaks about your departure, and as you watch the White House press room briefing, Sarah Huckabee Sanders responds to a question about you with, "Well, we didn't really know him that well. He was never the president's first choice for that position. He was barely part of cabinet meetings. The only time I recall seeing him was when he was getting coffee for other people. He might have just been a volunteer. We really didn't get a sense he was that important to the president." You blindly fumble for the remote control as you feel yourself disappearing, fading out of memory, a ghost of the Washington you thought had changed forever. Calls and emails to people who loved you just days ago go unreturned. You didn't get the book deal your wife hoped for. You can't get Fox to return your calls about being a contributor. Your old partners at your lobbying firm or PR shop or PAC or cagey, offering to get dinner one night soon, somewhere away from downtown so we can talk. This is rock bottom, right? Wrong. As you're sitting in your office packing your few belongings into a shipping box, your soon-to-be ex-assistant pings your intercom. "Sir, it's Mr. Mueller's office on line 2. It's urgent." You realize that asshole Rick Wilson was right all along. Everything Trump touches dies. Part 2. Victims of the Curse. Inside the Oval Office. A comedy in 5 acts. Act 1. You hate the idea at first that this is all one big reality television show, but it doesn't take too many weeks to see that's just what it is. You really wish you'd watched more of The Apprentice when it was on. You'd try to catch up, but as a very young White House staffer, it's honestly just too much of your limited 6 hours a day of downtime. Lord knows you're grateful to be working here. You know that previous White Houses were stacked with Harvard, Yale, and Princeton types, and as a recent graduate from the University of Alabama, getting this chance was more than you could have dreamed. Luckily, your mama's cousin's best friend met Mike Huckabee at Seaside one summer, and that got you a VIP invite to the big rally in Mobile, and you met Mr. Lewandowski, and off you went. You'd done an internship with Jeff Sessions when he was in the Senate, and somehow that was good enough to get you here. Sure wasn't your 3.1 GPA. Maybe it was just luck. Your daddy's car dealership meant he was always a solid donor, and he liked Mr. Trump from the start. It didn't hurt. They seem real sensitive around here to who was with the president early and who joined the Trump train later. Your moment comes early, when POTUS himself is outside the Oval yelling at Sean Spicer, "Don't you own a goddamn dark suit? Where do you buy suits like that, Walmart?" You're walking down the hallway with papers for Mr. Priebus and trying not to make eye contact, but POTUS eyes you from head to toe. He approves. "See, Sean? See?" he squawks, glaring at you. "What's your name?" You tell him, barely squeezing out your name, "John Fairhope, Mr. President." "See, Sean? Antelope here wears a dark suit with a good tie. You look like a fucking schlub," the leader of the free world says angrily. Spicer's eyes are dead, his skin pale and beaded with sweat. You try really, really hard not to breathe. The president swings his gaze to you and says, "Where do you work, Tone Loke?" You stammer out, "I'm working in the chief of staff's office as a deputy assistant for..." He interrupts, "Not anymore!" Your life just changed. You don't know it yet, but not for the better. Chapter 5. What We Lost with Trump. Donald Trump is a terrible president. That's not an aesthetic judgment. It's not a partisan judgment. It's a simple tally of his incompetence, recklessness, and the costs he's imposing on a nation he was elected to lead. I'm not talking about the usual Washington problems, but the bigger, more sweeping costs we face as a nation. The predicate of Never Trump wasn't simply that he couldn't be president, it was that he shouldn't be president. A brief look at the tally of our diminished state follows. Leadership. Presidential leadership has that ineffable, know-it-when-you-see-it quality, a quicksilver property that ebbs and flows with the arc of lives and fortunes of the men who hold the highest office in the land. It's either there or it isn't. We saw it in George Washington, not just in the battles he waged and won and the example he set as a leader, but in his dignified departure from power and his return to Mount Vernon after sacrificing so much for so long. He led during the time of our greatest early adversity and never let the power of office or position overtake him. Sometimes it's a determination to do the right thing, damn the consequences, the anger and dissent it will cause. Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation almost ended his presidency and eventually cost him his life, but he never wavered. He led in word and action, demanding incalculable sacrifice to prevent incalculable harm to the Republic. It was John F. Kennedy's call, rallying a nation facing down communism, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, in order to assure the survival and success of liberty. It was Ronald Reagan standing tall and resolute before the Brandenburg Gate, rapping out the cadences of the end of 70 years of Soviet oppression, confident that our way of life, our values, and our system were superior to communism. It's FDR in the well of the House, dragging a nation from the opiate stupor of comfortable isolationism and unleashing our military and industrial might in a devastating war to end the threat of Nazism, fascism, and Japanese militarism. It doesn't always come from a crafted, perfect speech. Sometimes it's a haggard, strained George W. Bush mounting a fire truck in the smoking ruins of the World Trade Center, throwing his arm around a firefighter and telling a grieving, angry nation, "I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon." These are just a handful of examples in the long, brilliant catalog of American presidential leadership. Their styles were different, but they were all grounded in our national character. Their leadership skills rose to meet the responsibilities of the office. Leadership takes two things Donald Trump notoriously and evidently lacks: character and an ability to engage in political acts that go beyond oneself. He is almost completely obsessed with the spectacle of Trump, the performative presidency that's all about his ratings, his appearance, his coverage. These are small and shallow things, an anathema to selfless national leadership. To be sure, every president has pondered his legacy and his role in history. They are still human, after all. But Donald Trump ponders only how Fox and Friends covers the previous day. Presidential leadership has never before been about tweeting, preening, or boasting. It hasn't been an endless exercise in self-flagellation until now. Dignity. Who could have imagined that a man of Donald Trump's spectacular vulgarity, vanity, and Jimcrack gold-leaf aesthetic would turn out to be a president without a shred of dignity? Who would have thought a man with a grasp of history derived solely from movies and television would be unable to channel the wonder and power of this nation in times of crisis? Who could imagine that a serial adulterer with a desperate need to have his manhood validated and who engaged in a string of risible, sleazy affairs would become an international laughingstock? Who could have foreseen that the faux billionaire up to his ample ass in debt to God knows who would look at the White House as a way to nickel and dime the taxpayers and the GOP into bumping up his revenue stream at his hotels and golf courses? Spoiler, everyone ever. Those of you who hoped the awesome power and majesty of the presidency would draw Trump away from decades of tawdry, low behavior were in for a rude surprise. George Washington embodied presidential dignity in a way that was transferred by some providential magic to almost every man who has held the highest office. Not so with Trump. Henry Cabot Lodge once wrote of our first president, "Washington cared as little for vain shows as any man who ever lived, but he had the highest sense of personal dignity and of the dignity of his cause and country. Neither should be allowed to suffer in his hands. He appreciated the effect on mankind of forms and titles, and with unerring judgment he insisted on what he knew to be of real value. It is one of the earliest examples of the dignity and good taste which were of such inestimable value to his country." Donald Trump is like a monster from the laboratory of a jackass mad scientist built to represent the perfect antithesis of Washington's example. In almost every aspect of his demeanor, speech, and affect, Trump is a clownish figure, a deserved magnet for mockery. From his absurd hair construct, to his ludicrous ego, to his pathetic, whiny need to have his alpha male status affirmed at every moment, Trump is the least dignified president since William Howard Taft held a jello wrestling contest on the South Lawn. His Liberace meets Saddam decorating style has always screamed out, "Not quite our class, dear," and his personality is the very opposite of commander-in-chief material. Trump is the living, shitty embodiment of a culture that's more Real Housewives and less Shining City on a Hill. No man is perfect in this regard. But even by the standards of today, Donald Trump's grasping, horrid ego reduces him to a clownish figure, easily, imminently, and most important, deservedly mockable. He's always too conscious of how he looks on the small screen of television rather than on the vast stage of the world. Everything about him screams need, insecurity, false bravado. Why does dignity matter in a president? Because at some point in every administration, history comes knocking. Tragedy strikes. The nation looks to the man they elected to lead them and whispers, "Now what?" Large and small, natural disasters, terrorist attacks, and other crises require a president to be a moral leader, to guide, to heal, to comfort, to direct the painful energies of a hurt nation into a positive direction. Trump can't stop looking in the mirror. A self-obsessed narcissus in a fright wig. Truth and facts. Post-truth American politics goes beyond the traditional best spin model of political communications both parties have embraced for generations. Setting the Trump campaign's endless torrent of bullshit aside for a moment, the tragedy of a presidency and a party that will argue endlessly and fruitlessly about basic, incontestable facts is a truly terrible sign of the corrosive nature of this man and his machine. I've been behind the glass watching enough focus groups to know that very few Americans trust anyone in Washington. Their hatred of politicians is transpartisan. Their baseline positions that Washington is full of lying liars who lie. Trump took that to levels no one could have imagined before, and we're going to regret it at home and abroad. On the domestic front, no one in Washington trusts Donald Trump, not even his staff, his allies in Congress, and certainly not anyone else in the legislative or political process. He's a serial liar of such infamy that any promise he makes is known at once to be conditional, ephemeral, and deniable. More Americans believe Donald Trump is dishonest than believe that of any president since Nixon. Roughly two-thirds of Americans view him as being untrustworthy across almost all survey data sources. That's hardly a distinction any resident of the Oval Office desires. Facts, as Reagan famously said, are stubborn things. Truth and honesty are vital pillars of presidential leadership. They create an ineffable reservoir of goodwill for the moments when the man in the Oval Office can't tell Americans all the details of a military or law enforcement operation. They are a buttress against attacks on his programs, his intentions, and his statements. Leadership demands trust. Trust that the president will keep his word, do as he promises, and deliver on commitments. Donald Trump, the Munchausen of presidents, is a notorious serial liar and fabulist. He is a liar and a man who has boasted about his own dishonesty in life, marriage, and business. Vision. Describe Donald Trump's vision for America without using a slogan. I'll wait. You might argue that Trump has a kind of negative vision, a mental landscape of threats, horrors, imagined enemies, Fox News boogeymen, and other members of his nightmare closet. But beyond his infamous vague catchphrase, MAGA, there's not much to latch onto when it comes to a presidential vision. His base, quite evidently, loves having their fear centers endlessly stimulated by his constant drip of apocalyptic conspiratorial rhetoric, and revels in triggering the snowflake libtard rhinos. But Trump's actual vision for America is a dim-witted slogan, not a plan. Make America Great Again is a retrospective, pessimistic throwaway, a callback to an imagined past. It's superficial boob bait that isn't matched up against a plan, a program, or a vision beyond l'état c'est Trump. Left or right, most presidents have some kind of endpoint, some shape of the American landscape they want to see. It's the fundamental programming layer of their plans, policies, and rhetoric. Trump's MAGA line is as dazzlingly superficial as the rest of his mental processes, and aside from a wall to stop Mexicans and some form of amorphous swamp draining, you'd be hard-pressed to lay out a Trump doctrine. Domestically, it's a mishmash of news of the week. Internationally, Make America Great Again is translated as cede American leadership to Russia. One person in Trump's orbit understood the need to articulate a broader vision than look at my bigly hands, America, and it was Pollyanna Conway. From time to time, she could convince him to read words on a teleprompter or draft a tweet for him that made him look a little less self-absorbed. But Trump's vision is for his brand, his company, and his bottom line, not the United States of America. Optimism. For Americans, the future is always coming, shiny, amazing, and prosperous. The founders were, at their base, optimists. Every generation of Americans has held on to the idea that we're getting better, moving toward the music of our better angels, fixing the bugs, hacking in new code, and building a better tomorrow. Downnote Trumpism is fundamentally pessimistic. It's a picture of America in decline, of evil foreigners beating us at trade, of problems only a strong man can solve, and the idea that the amorphous left is winning all the battles. This isn't Reagan's sunny optimism. Is depressingly small and limited in scope. The Trump train stops at a podunk future that looks like 1930, not 2030. Big, visionary, prospective leadership has always been informed by the bullheaded optimism that defines this country. We aren't just passengers. We're builders, dreamers, doers, fighters. No challenge is too big. No problem is too complex. Every time the world thinks we can't, we do. America, fuck yeah, has become daddy save us in the age of Trump. It's one of the things I find most depressing about Trump. He's trained his docile followers to believe in an America that is weaker, sadder, and smaller than we really are. I remain militantly optimistic about America, our rich talent, and our amazing, messy, wonderful, crazy, ridiculous, passionate people. It's too bad a central tenet of Trumpism is to run down the people of this country and describe a nation so lost and weak it requires an authoritarian strongman. Focus. Donald Trump has the attention span of a gnat on meth. If he was stonked to the gills on Adderall, he might achieve the attention span of a toddler. This is a man with a notoriously shallow intellect and a marked inability to stick to a consistent line of thinking. It's hard to determine if he simply can't remember what he said at any given moment, or whether the bright and shiny objects around him are too much of a distraction. Because his governance style is a combination of tabloid beefing, tweet rages, and pick-the-worst policy games, it takes the hallucinatory belief by his followers that Trump is merely playing multidimensional chess, pursuing some secret, brilliantly considered scheme to MAGA. right up until he changes the subject again. In Trump, we will never have a president able to marshal his and the nation's attention to any challenge. This is a feature of Trumpism, not a bug. He depends on the constant, endless chaos and static of exploding our attention span, pinballing from one crisis to the next. You can imagine him saying, "I don't want to talk about Mueller. How about I bomb Syria instead?" Unity. Trump has divided us in ways no American of good faith can countenance. He's the ultimate us versus them president. A man who stokes partisan tribalism, racial animosity, and political division for sport. He relishes division. He flirts with racial forces that no sane president would do anything but rebuke and shun. He refuses to make even the most tangential moves toward bipartisan harmony. He encourages a paranoid, constant war with the media. He wrecks the rule of law, ignores the traditions of presidential leadership, and never fails to stoke division when he should bring the country together. The only unity emerging in the era of Trump is on the negative side. He's drawn people together in a vocal, constant, furious anger. No modern political figure, left or right, has had more people hate him with a mad, burning passion than Donald Trump. Rhetoric and invective. I love a good scrap. I always have. Politics should have a spectrum of rhetorical engagement, from profound philosophical discussions down to a good verbal street fight. Hell, if you've ever seen me on television, you know I'm an equal opportunity asshole who doesn't mind mixing it up. This tradition of hot rhetoric in politics stretches back to the Founding Fathers, who would name-call, smear, and drop ye old oppo like champions. Trump-era name-calling is just as tiresome and juvenile as it is nonsensical. It's not that I mind fighting with Trump's cheer squad, bot armies, pet journalists, and allies. It's that it's so rarely a fair fight. Snowflake. Social justice warrior. Rhino. Libtard. Cuck. I could go on, but you've seen them 100 times if you've been anywhere near social media since the rise of Trump. A party once defined by the smart articulation of a conservative worldview that sought to limit the power of the state, ensure the primacy of our values, and advocated for free minds and free markets, now plays a kind of Hannitian bingo. Random insults from a playbook so subliterate it barely rises above pictograms or strung into some stochastic pattern and blurted out over the nearest social media timeline. With the rise of social media as Trump World's primary communications domain, you can reliably expect any argument to end with variations on the theme of, "Did I trigger your liberal cuck tears, Snowflake? What about Benghazi? What about her emails? What about Obama's long-form birth certificate? Mueller's the traitor, traitor. You want Sharia communism, don't you? How much is Soros paying you? You're the real racist, shill." Baffled? Don't be. Trumpism exists in the shallow end of the rhetorical pool. The very, very shallow end, where its users ignored the no-diving sign and still suffer some rocking head trauma from the experience. Their reliance on these simple chains of concatenated insults betrays the reality that something much more profound is wrong with conservative and Republican thought. Movements depend on ideas and an underpinning philosophy. The word-finder Republicans aren't making arguments. They're just venting, pecking like chickens for tiny fragments of snark, hoping to seem witty without actually possessing even the slightest wit. Their efforts to insult their betters aren't exactly a towering intellectual effort, but what can you expect from people quite obviously raised on a diet of plastic jug vodka and lead paint chips, or from those credulous enough to follow a man whose central rhetorical tendency is to berate his opponents with middle school nicknames? I know this reeks of elitism in the era of Trump. But would it be too much to ask that before Trump fans sling MAGA insults, they learn the distinction between the contraction "your" and the possessive "your"? Would it take too much time from the Real Housewives of Appalachia to learn even the bare basics of English grammar, spelling, capitalization, and punctuation? Everyone makes spelling and grammatical errors. Hell, I promise you there are going to be some in this book. For most people, those mistakes are occasional bugs. For Team MAGA, they're a core feature. A TweetDeck or Chrome "Your Indifferent Grammar is Killing Me" plugin would help. Perhaps it's time for Microsoft to bring back Clippy, the pop-up icon that suggests things like, "Are you sure you really want to tweet this, moron?" Comedy is hard. Wit is harder. Stringing together a recycled package of 20 or so insults over and over again is right up the intellectual alley of the average Trump fan. Bonus points for lots of MAGA hashtags. Inside the Oval Office. Act 2. As the deputy special under-assistant to the president for unspecified duties, you have an office so small your elbows touch the walls. Your desk is barely the size of a milk crate, and you have to engage in some gymnastics to get to your chair. It would be a cliché to say your office in the West Wing is a closet, but this would make a closet look palatial. You pinch yourself, though, every morning. You're working in the White House, for the president, in the West Wing. You've made it to the locomotive on the Trump train, and you're never going to look back. No one knows quite what your job is, including you. The president yelled at Reince that he wanted you promoted because he looks the fucking part. Get me guys who look the fucking part, Reincey. The president hasn't given you a nickname, good or bad, but you're at work every morning, looking sharp and ready to MAGA. Hopix eyeballs you for the first few days, wondering if you're trustworthy. Kellyanne Conway keeps walking past your office and eyeballing you. She can't decide whether to ignore you or devour you. Her eyes remind you of those gators you'd see floating in the Mobile Tensaw River back home. Jared asks one day, "So, Fartloaf, where did you go to school?" When you tell him Alabama, his eyes glaze over and he wanders away, whispering, "Alabama? Interesting." The next morning, Ivanka stands in the door of your office, sleek and groomed to within an inch of her life. You can't quite parse her expression. Her voice is like honey. "Jared tells me your daddy's mysterious new ideas, man. Thank God, because entre nous," she drops to a whisper that makes you feel both trusted and slightly aroused. "All of Bannon's public ideas are terrible, and the ones he talks about when he and Miller and Gorka get drunk are probably war crimes." She rests her perfectly manicured hand on yours. It's cool, almost preternaturally so. She stares into your soul and says, "We're going to be friends, aren't we, Fairlane?" You manage to croak, "Of course, Mrs. Cush." "Shh. Jared only calls me that when he's in the punishment box. Call me Ivanka." She slides a business card across the tiny desk. "And do call me." Chapter 6. The Media. Conservatives waged war on the media for decades, and the media won. Far from spelling the end of the mainstream press, Trump's election gave the national, professional mainstream media a moment and a mission that has produced a golden age of journalism. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Daily Beast, the Atlantic, the Los Angeles Times, CNN, and MSNBC are expanding their audiences and prospering like never before. The inverse of the everything Trump touches dies curse has been a blessing for the national media, as reporters have rediscovered a commitment to working sources, breaking news, and kicking down doors to get stories. Trump combines uniquely newsworthy behaviors, a constant flirtation with the edges of the law, a clown car administration staffed by the corrupt, the creepy, and the craven, and a temperament better suited to an asylum than to the Oval Office. For decades, the rallying cry on the right was, "But the liberal media." It was the quickest route to explaining any failing on the right flank of our politics. Failure to repeal Obamacare? Liberal media. American stubborn love of Medicare and Social Security? Liberal media. The cancellation of Firefly? Liberal media. Duh. If only we could overcome the liberal media monoculture, the truth and strength of our ideas would finally break through, was the spoken and tacit assumption in every battle. If only we could really be heard on economic matters, on foreign affairs, and on race, the Republican Party and conservatism would finally get a fair hearing in the minds of the American people, was a common argument. It wouldn't have to be a zero-sum game of replacing one set of biases with another. The rightness of our ideas would carry the day. Uh-huh. How'd that work out? Yes, the mainstream media often deserves a kick in the ass so hard they would reach orbital velocity for their professional missteps, insularity, ideological blinders, vast self-regard, and occasional outright malice against conservatives. Yes, they make mistakes, large and small, every day. Reporters and editors have every human flaw and weakness that everyone else has. There are ideological bad actors in the media, as there are in every other institution. However, as a justification for every one of Trump's failings, reveling in their misery falls wildly short of the mark. A movement that once took pride in its intellectual rigor and was graced by the ideas of Burke, Hayek, Weaver, Friedman, Kirk, and Buckley, today views the feces flinging by Breitbart and a constellation of kook-right conspiracy sites that would make Lyndon LaRouche blush as highbrow conservative commentary. It's not an argument for mainstream media malpractice, Obama, Clinton, social justice silliness, George Soros, or the Pentaveret to say that imitating the worst behavior of the press doesn't exactly honor the ideals we claim to serve or elevate the conservative message. Instead, it makes a mockery of our ideas if we believe a Trump-centric media monoculture is a positive outcome and that screaming fake news is a substitute for advocacy and argument. Yes, in 2008, the press lost their damn collective minds. The first Obama campaign benefited from a tidal wave of largely uncritical adulation. The superlatives flowed in a ridiculous, flowery stream of praise that bordered at times on the creepy. Yes, the one was a media absurdity. I remember emailing a reporter this snarky note after reading one of her pieces. Are you practicing writing Mrs. Catherine Obama in loopy script in your MASH book? Name withheld to protect the embarrassed. They spoke and wrote about Obama in terms so glowing and so toadying it was easy to caricature the journalist class of 2008 as a group of fangirls squeeing and fainting at his every utterance. That nearly mindless rah-rah remained a constant element in Obama's coverage until he walked out of the Oval Office. Conservatives rightly mocked it, but the smarter types recognized it as an example of the normative power of media and pop culture. The two had combined in one fell swoop to overcome Barack Obama's thin resume, his lack of experience, and questions about his ideological underpinnings. Donald Trump wasn't the first celebrity president. Yes, the press treated Hillary as Her Majesty the President-in-Waiting, glass-ceiling shatterer for the epoch, and ignored her terrible campaigns and clunky persona and the defective robot affect she displayed on the campaign trail. That's no excuse for the coverage of the 2016 Republican presidential campaigns or of this presidency, where coverage was driven by InfoWars and Breitbart. Trump fans aren't looking for up-the-middle coverage. They're looking for partners in the fake news explosion that helped Trump win the election. If being a Republican means buying into stories so obviously, barkingly insane that they sound like Roger Stone's conspiracy rantings after a three-day meth bender, then we don't have a political party. We have an inpatient mental health facility. To remind you once again, a meaningful fraction of Republicans believe that Hillary Clinton was running a global child sex and cannibalism ring from the basement of a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant. If conservative media is to mean something outside the narrowest confines of the base, it needs to be honest, direct, and critical of our failings. Conservatives who legitimize the creepy authoritarianism, unalloyed racism, and apocalyptic religious and cultural war fantasies on the pages of Breitbart, Gateway Pundit, and the dog's breakfast of other Trump fan news, they're not building conservatism. They're creating a filter bubble as wrong-headed and as dysfunctional as the one they imagine exists at the New York Times or MSNBC. Good journalism ought to matter on the right and not fall into the slavish corruption of basic journalistic practices in service to the preferred narrative. Good writing and reporting ought to matter. As for my friends in the mainstream press, you're not off the hook. No matter how much Republicans claim to hate the media, let's be clear. Without the active participation of the mainstream media in the greatest scam on earth, Donald Trump wouldn't be president. The mainstream media helped elect him through its constant attention to his every utterance. Why did they do this? Didn't they hate Trump and love Hillary? Sure, quite a few thought he'd be easy meat for Hillary in the general election. But as with everything, money explains most of their behavior. Finally, the networks had a presidential election that had all the draw of professional wrestling and all the heat of a table-flipping, hair-pulling reality television show. CNN President Jeff Zucker had produced Trump's The Apprentice and knew good TV when he saw it. Rupert Murdoch had already pushed Fox into a position where it would net more than $1 billion, but CNN had long lagged behind Trump state television's profits. In 2016, CNN's ratings and gross profits spiked sharply higher, crossing the $1 billion mark for the first time in its 36-year history. Donald Trump, as heinous as he is as a person, a leader, and a president, is must-see television. And American cable networks made several $1 billion proving that Americans love reality television. The more vulgar and loud, the better, even when the fate of the nation is involved. Inside the Oval Office, Act 3. The first early morning call is a little shocking. It's 5:54 and you're clearing in through White House security. You've been in line for 15 minutes already. While you're walking through the mags, your phone beeps with a blocked number. You answer. The President of the United States bellows, "Fruit Loop! Listen to this tweet idea! Listen!" He reads it and your mind is blank. Something about a witch hunt, Mueller, Crooked Hillary, and the wall. It's so fast you could barely process it. Then the President is back. "Do you like it? I like it. Should we do it?" You respond the only way you know how. "Yes, Mr. President, it's a great one," or something similar. You honestly can't think of another way to do it. Moments later, everyone in the line ahead of you is staring at their phones. Those who aren't are dragging their handsets out of purses and pockets. At 6:01, the President sends out a tweet saying, "Crooked Hillary, who could not win an election due to low stamina, now directs a witch hunt against me. Ironic. Crooked Hillary is the witch. Get on your broom and ride back to Mueller, Mr. Witch Hunt." Several more follow, and your guts turn to water. By the time you're in your office, it's on every network. Sarah Sanders stands in the door of your office heaving. "You little shit. He says you wrote that tweet." She's livid, her eyes practically rolling and her nostrils flaring. "He called me about—" She interrupts. "I know he called you. He told me. I can tell you one thing. After the shit with Spicer and Scaramucci, I'm still here and they're not. I'll survive you, too. And I better not hear any leaks about how you're the new Wonder Boy." She won't listen to your innocent explanation, and you know you've made an enemy without trying. You've been on a couple of trips now, and reporters are starting to wonder who you are. It's awkward, because the truth is that reporters terrify you. You know people around you leak. A lot. That weird little wolf guy is always in Bannon's office. Reporters are everywhere in this White House, and it's obvious that it won't go well in the end. So, you keep your mouth shut. Chapter 7. The Trump Base. For Trump, his famous, "I love the poorly educated" line was a throwaway. But for those of us watching the Trump Party's metastatic growth in the summer and fall of 2015 and early 2016, it was blindingly obvious. As much as Trump apologists want to gussy it up with some pseudo-intellectual cruft, the hot core of Trumpism is a group of Americans who are the perfect marks for a con man like Trump, anxious over economic and social status markers in a changing world. Sure, they're looking for a place for both their anger and uncertainty to be heard. But they're also looking for someone to blame. If there's a sharper critique of America's failed education system than the breathless, mindless Trump voter, I can't name it. Given the dumbing down of the American educational system in the past 50 years, graduating from high school now means you can draw air in and out of your lungs. Schools are long on feelings and short on critical thinking, to say nothing of civics, economics, or reading comprehension. It's not a point of pride any longer. The weaknesses, vagaries, and generally terrible nature of our alleged education system is a longer topic for another time. But where was Trump's strongest support? You guessed it. You know the rest, and since base demographics are partly political destiny, the demos tell the story. Trump supporters are older, whiter, less educated, and more southern and Midwestern than the mean, and their income ranks in the average range. They love God, television, and Fox News. Economic anxiety and stagnation are two of the ostensible drivers of Trump Party membership. The poor get everything for free and the rich get all the tax breaks, in many ways perfectly captures the Troll Party belief set. They're not entirely wrong, but quite a lot of the poor getting things for free applies to them. Food stamps, disability, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security dependents aren't exactly foreign concepts to many Trump voters. It speaks to the fact that Trump's notorious base is impervious to reason and immune to irony, and is still a deep mystery to many who aren't Trump supporters. They're willful, petulant, and full of pointless defiance. They've become defined by an obsession with Trump as the sole remedy for the offenses imposed on them by a rotating cast of villains and evildoers. In the process, they become easy marks for every flavor of conspiratorial lunacy and gimcrack appeals to their worst instincts. I know I'm not supposed to mock Trump's base. It's elitist and cruel, and oh, who am I kidding? Honestly, at this point, it's almost a moral imperative to slap the stupid out of them. So I'll dispense with the brief, obligatory nod to their hard-working, God-fearing American salt-of-the-earth values and return swiftly to being an elitist asshole. Because by God, they've earned it. There's an entire journalistic enterprise these days trying to tell people who don't sit in trailers all day watching reality television whilst shoveling down corn syrup and soy-based salty sweet Walmart brand bacon cheese snacks into their maws about how the other America is the only real America. As a corner of political anthropology, it's fascinating. But it's been repurposed as an excuse for Trumpism, including its most hateful pathologies. We're supposed to be the no-excuses daddy party, remember? Imagine your teenager says, "Dad, I'm going out to get a lip piercing and some fierce face tattoos." A responsible parent says, "Low back on that, kiddo. This is an unwise life decision." When your teenage daughter says, "Dad, I know I'm only 14, but Roy says age is just a number, and he's like a judge, and he's 32, and I love him," the correct response is not a nod of approval, but to reach for a shotgun. So Trump's base voters shouldn't get a free pass from the right lane. They don't get a pat on the head because of bullshit economic anxiety or NAFTA or whatever other ouchies they got from the brown people and the robots they think took their jobs. They don't get to scream about welfare queens and then sit idly shoveling down OxyContin like candy while waiting for their EBT cards to recharge and their disability checks to hit. They don't get to bitch about triggered liberal snowflake social justice warriors while nursing a set of grievances that lead them to spittle-flecked outrage at the slightest challenge to their worldview. This isn't simply some elitist rant. It's the tough parental love that Fox and talk radio never gave them. It's the switch to the backside when they start quoting InfoWars unironically, something that might have corrected the conspiracy craziness a lot earlier in the process. The political correctness culture that makes so much of the left utterly fucking insufferable is all about punishing wrong thoughts. Sadly, the Trump right is just as intolerant of people who vary from their narrow set of beliefs and values as the most fervent social justice warrior on the left. They're just as dedicated to suppressing speech they dislike. Ask Michelle Wolf, or any NFL player who took a knee to protest police misconduct. It's not the top-level values of the middle American voters who came out for Trump that bother me. It's their contradictions, moral blindness, and embrace of the tantrum over the idea, and rage over principle. I'm not blaming them entirely either. Like many others in the professional political class, I missed a huge signal in their behavior and their affect. We always thought of conservatives as having a certain level-headed, rational underpinning. We were so, so wrong. Fanatical MAGA voters who elected Trump are more like Obama voters than we wanted to admit. We should have seen this coming because people like me helped grow them as a political force. Let's get this mea culpa out of the way. After the 2010 elections, we learned to motivate and activate Tea Party voters, even for candidates who weren't a perfect fit for Tea Party purists. We knew they were out there, and we identified them, targeted them, motivated them. We just didn't understand they weren't waiting for a conservative revolution. They were instead waiting for a strongman, a caudillo, a Saddam. They didn't really care about fiscal conservatism. These were conservatives unmoved by arguments about the debt, the deficit, or the Constitution. They didn't really care about reducing the size of government. In the end, they were just angry at a changing America, a changing economy, and the people who didn't look or sound like them. fed by Fox News, talk radio, and weaponized Facebook feeds custom designed to engorge their feelings of fury, resentment, and impotence, they were looking at a world that was evolving socially, technologically, and politically at a Kurzweilian rate. In short, those voters we groomed since 2010 were perfect marks for Donald Trump, political con man of the century.